Rabbi, welcome. Can't wait to. There's so much to go through. There is something that I've seen in the Maharal, which I wanted to give you, even though what the Maharal says is a couple of verses behind, it is still extremely negaya. It's extremely pertinent to understand the next thing that we're going to learn. So even though this is out of sync, I'd like to go back, which we've done, to 6:4, just very quickly. We're not going to do it in depth, but there's one point from the Maharal which is literally golden, and I have to give it to you. So if you look at 6:4, it says, the king said, who's in the courtyard? I.e., where's the guy that's in charge of making these records? And I said, oh, Haman's in the courtyard. Haman accounts to the outer courtyard of the palace. Now listen to this. To tell the king that he should hang Mordechai, al ha'etz asher haychin loy, upon the tree or the gallows which he had prepared for him. Now that is obviously understood to mean upon the gallows that Haman had prepared for Mordechai. However, the Medrash says, actually, the Medrash Rabbah on this point, you can read it, upon the gallows he had prepared for him, i.e. himself. Which obviously is actually the truth. He's actually preparing these gallows for him. But he says, so says the Maharal, and this is very important for going into tonight's shiur, says the Maharal on Medrash Esther Rabbah Yud Base 10:2, he says as follows. He says, a beautiful law, quotes the Maharal, he quotes the laws of physics. The Maharal talks about the laws of physics. You're going to love it. He says as follows. Let's say you try to hurl a very heavy stone by a catapult at a large wall. You're besieging a wall. And you take one of those huge catapults and you chuck this big heavy boulder at the bricks. If that boulder is heavy enough and thrown with enough force, it will topple the wall over. Now he says, how does that happen? He says what's happening is you're loading the catapult with a lot of kinetic potential and you're releasing that kinetic potential into the stone. And the stone, just a second, the stone becomes loaded with energy. And the energy is dumped into the wall. So all that energy that was in the rock hits the wall and it topples the bricks. That's where the energy comes from to knock the bricks over, from the energy that was stored in the boulder. He says as follows. Imagine if you're going to chuck a catapult with the same stone in at a wall made of solid iron. Now he says, when that happens, all the energy that's loaded into the boulder hits the iron, but the iron does not succumb or react to that energy in the same way as the bricks, and it actually bounces the rock off and back at you in your direction. And if it lands in your direction and causes chaos to your army, where did the energy come from to cause that chaos? Where did the energy come from for that roller to land back at your feet? The answer is, all the energy you put into the catapult to start with is still in the rock. It got bounced off the iron wall because the iron wall wouldn't receive that energy. You didn't have enough energy to push through the iron wall. So the rock bounced back towards you with the same energy you yourself put into the rock to start with. That's the analogy of the Maharal Maprag. How does he apply it like this? He says like this. He says what's happening here in the Megillah, in this sixth perek, is nothing but the laws of physics. It's the Maharal that says this. It's the laws of physics. Listen to this. He says like this. He says, if a guy has a plan to hurt his fellow and he hatches a plot, I don't know, to discredit him or make a smear campaign you name it. That guy, if he succumbs to that plot, the reason he succumbed was all the energy that the perpetrator had in making the plot against him. And that plot has come to fruition, and now that guy's in trouble. Just the way the plot said. But when you're taking Klal Yisrael, says the Maharal, Klal Yisrael are God's own people. They're his people. They're like an iron wall. He will not allow them to be destroyed. He won't. So what will happen? The rock will bounce off an iron wall. That's why every single thing Haman did came back to him. He wanted to pay off Klal Yisrael. They responded with the merit of the tzedakah of the machtzitz shekel, as we learnt. He wanted to kill Klal Yisrael. He and all his family were killed. He wanted to hang Mordechai. He himself will be hanged on his own gallows. That's not so much an act. That's just where the... Who's putting the energy in for this? He is. All the things he was doing and putting energy into to make this happen all fell at his feet because the energy reverberated back at him because heaven wouldn't allow the energy he was putting in to hit Klal Yisrael and topple them, which means the stone bounced off and landed back at his feet. The very things which he himself were using to undermine Klal Yisrael bounced off and landed at him and actually toppled him. That's why it says in 6:4, he was talking about the gallows he was building to hang him on. To hang him on is hang himself on. That's why the Medrash Rabbah says that. Says the Maharal, it just stands to reason. The energy that an enemy of Israel uses to kill them will be the very energy that falls back on them. Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu won't allow it. So that is a system of physics here. It's a system of physics, says the Maharal. Absolutely outstanding piece of data. Now, what we ended off last time was that all the things that Mordechai did and suffered through for the sake of Klal Yisrael, God paid him back in this very perek to say, well done for everything you've done except for one thing. Your tearing of your garment goes to pay off Benjamin's tearing, causing his brothers to tear their garments when they found the kais, the becha, the cup, the goblet, in his knapsack back in Genesis 43. But apart from that, I'll pay you all off. Now, what do we learn from that? One who is degraded for the sake of heaven will consequently enjoy ascent to the greatest height. If you're taking a hit for God, that goes on God's bill, and he'll pay you back. He'll pay you back. He says, did you do that for me? He goes, uh-huh. All right, I'll do this for you. Measure for measure, whatever the hit is that you've taken for God, he will pay you back in spades. He guarantees it. One of the places we learn it out from is this Megillah. Right here. Really important idea. Now, for those who are very astute, you'll remember in 5:1, all the way back in 5:1, we darshened out a pasuk, 5:1, with a pasuk from Eiv, Job 29:14, that says, I donned justice, and it, justice, donned me. We used this pasuk, and that was Eiv, Job 29:14. And we said it was on the third day that Esther donned royalty and stood in the inner courtyard. Now, how did we use that pasuk to don it? We said like this, Esther really didn't feel like a queen. But this one day, she decided she's going to live up to the task. She put on her garments, mummish, like the empress of the world, and said, look, this is my role in life. I've got to do this. I've got to take the risk. I'm going to make this work. So I don justice, and justice donned me. What did we say? She didn't feel suited for a royal position. But when Mordechai saw through Haman's evil plans and told Esther, this is what you've got to do, she literally kitted herself out in her royal attire and mummish, her feet filled her shoes, as it were, her shoulders filled that, you know, that dress that she wore. She's the queen of the world and she's going to get this done. She's now got a mission. She's got a mission. And that's why on the third day, Esther donned royalty And she went in the fast, which is going on now, where we're holding in the sixth parak. And she went in on the second party. She's going to say, oh, my people have been sold. She's now queen. And again, that was quoted from Medrash Socha Toiv. That's the Medrash from Tehillim 24. And again, we're going to quote that on 6-8 going into 6-9, which is where we're holding. I was clothed or I donned justice and justice donned me. So it says the Yalkut Shemoni quotes this. Yalkut Shemoni 9:17 quotes this and says, sometimes a man graces his clothing, but his clothes do not grace him. And sometimes a man's clothing do enhance him, but he does not enhance his clothing. But when a person and his clothes both enhance each other, then they're said to fit well in their clothes, and their clothes fit well on him. That's what it means, that the wearer and the clothing grace each other. So now when Ahasuerus turns round to Haman and says, what should be done for the man whom the king wishes to honour? Haman incorporated both aspects of the royal attire in his request. He wanted to maximise his honour because he thought he was the person who the king intended to honour to start with. And that's why he said which he wore, the clothing which the king wore. Because the king graces the clothes he wore. And then Haman added, Boy HaMelech, literally the king in it. Because since it was such a splendid garment, the king was glorified by wearing that garment. The truth is that anyone wearing a red cape with ermine trim, except for the monarch, looks like he's at a fancy dress party. Let's be honest. If you went to a top tailor and spent £15,000 on a red cape with an ermine trim and then just went to, I don't know, the shops in that, you would make yourself an object of ridicule. But when the queen wears it, it's only fitting. And she herself graces the ermine and the ermine graces her. She says, that's the garment I want. That's interesting. And then he said, that's where we left off. Then he said, and that which is placed on the king's head, namely the royal crown. He said, could you imagine if the king wanted, sorry, the queen, Queen Elizabeth in our day, wanted to honour someone and they actually requested that the crown which the queen wore at her coronation should be bestowed on this person for a couple of hours. It's pasnished. It's just not right to even ask for that. But that's how far and greedy Haman was. Ad kedekach, he wanted nothing less than the actual crown itself. But Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer, section 50, says Haman requested the crown. I want the crown as well. But when Haman asked for that, Ahasuerus's face changed colour. He was so shocked that someone asked for that, his countenance, and Haman saw like the blood rush away from his face. And he was like, I can't believe this guy. Now remember, Haman was being led into a trap by Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus knew that the person he was going to honour was going to be Mordechai. Haman thought the person he's going to be honouring is Haman. But the mere concept that Haman is telling him who you want to honour should wear your crown is so dissatisfying that he himself bolted it. Now Haman understood that Haman thought Ahasuerus meant him. And that Ahasuerus didn't like the idea of giving his crown to Haman. So Haman got the heebie-jeebies because he was scared because he thought the king was now angry at him personally, not realizing the king didn't like the idea of having to give his crown to anyone else. The only reason he's doing this is to make sure people are willing to come to him with secret data that there might be a plot against him. And he specifically is suspicious of Haman and Esther at this particular time. But generally, it's a good protocol to make sure that he rewards people who have a plot against him because it's going to save his skin. So the idea of having to do this was extremely unpleasant and distasteful to Ahasuerus. But Haman thought he's in a dog box because he's the one that wants it and the king does not want to give his crown to Haman. That's what Haman's thinking. That's not what Ahasuerus is thinking. But Ahasuerus did see this as incredibly disdainful. So he said, so he was now scared to say that. So when the king's face changed, Haman wanted to explain his words to mean they should also bring that which was placed upon the king, which seems if it's not the royal crown, maybe he could explain that he was only referring to the horse. Maybe you could say that which is placed upon the king. Maybe you could say that that's the animal and the drapery around the animal, which I believe is called a caparison. The clothing that goes over a horse like you find in bullfighting rings of the rodeo members that go round the bull, they wear something called a caparison. So this was a garment that specifically goes around the horse. So he wanted to get himself out of trouble by saying that which is brought on the king, that the king wore on his head, is some kind of material that went on the horse as well. Because he got really scared about his own position when he said, I want the crown as well. He himself was scared for his own skin. So he tried to deflect it onto the horse, which is why there's a strange loshen in the actual pasuk where it says, and that which is placed upon his head, namely a royal crown. He got himself into trouble there. Verse 9 says, and let the garment and the horse be given to a man who is one of the king's noble ministers. Put the reins in a noble minister's hand. And that noble minister should clothe it. He should be the one that clothes the man who the king desires to honor. And he should be the one, this noble minister, should lead him on the horse in the city square, in public. And let this minister call out before him, thus will be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Why is this going to be done? Obviously, Ahasuerus likes the plan because it makes it very, very public that anyone that saves Ahasuerus's skin, in this case, Mordechai with Bigson and Seresh, as an example, will be very amply rewarded. And if a minister is walking about, that means he'll have protection from all the ministers and he shouldn't feel scared to grass up someone at a very, very high level who probably has a lot of influence yet to save the king's life. But Haman doesn't know that. Haman thinks he's going to get one of the ministers to dress him and lead him on the king's horse around the city streets being proclaimed as a hero. That's what Haman thinks. Now, Haman noted that the king was very angry at his suggestion of this person wearing the crown, who he thought was him. You know, Haman was going to get it. So what did he do? He slyly revised his previous statement in verse 8, saying, and let the garment and the horse be given. So the words garment and horse would seem superfluous, because Haman already told about him in verse 8. He could have said, let them be given, and we'd know it's the horse and the garment. So he specified these items to say, I only meant that the garment of the horse be brought, but not the actual crown itself. This is all to get him out of the trouble that he foresaw Ahasuerus with his facial countenance change, that maybe he himself would get into trouble. And he wanted to convince the king that he never actually meant the crown itself, and that no one else could ever actually wear that, right? Rather, these things should be given over into the hands of noble ministers who will then dress this person. That's what I was referring to. Things that would go, as it were, all the way to the head of the king. Not, I mean, obviously, not the crown, obviously, right? He had to try to, like, you know, kind of save the day there. Verse 10. Vayomer Hamelech Lahaman. Said the king back to Haman, Maher! Quickly! Kach esalavush ve'esasus! Notice, he says, take the garment and the horse, which are the things that Haman has just clarified in verse 9. Just as you have spoken, and do so to Mordechai, Hayahudi. Why do we need that word? That is a word that we're going to need to talk about later. That is an important word. Just say Mordechai, not Mordechai Hayahudi. Who sits at the king's gate? Did he not know where he would be? Now listen to this. Al tapel davar mikol Asher Dibarta. Now, this is usually translated as do not omit a single thing from all that you've suggested. But that's not literal. That is a contextual translation, which is a good contextual translation. What it really means is don't let a word fall from everything that you've said. Don't let a word fall. Now, let's just revise what we're doing here. Why did the king want to do this whole thing, this whole palaver to start with? Answer, he wanted to seek someone out that would know of a supposed conspiracy against him, specifically in this case between Haman and Esther. And he wanted that person to reveal the secret in detail to the king. So Ahasuerus was thinking, if all these honours are going to be performed through other people, the potential informant that I'm seeking in this case might refuse to come forward because he'll say, who dares come between Haman and Esther, the second and third most powerful humans on earth? And those great people are not like Bigson and Suresh. Haman and Esther are far more powerful, and I daren't risk my life approaching the king in front of such powerful people. So Ahasuerus aimed to humble Haman himself for the sake of the man that reveals the secrets. Because when people in the street see Haman having to lead someone else on a horse through the street, they say, aha, he's not that powerful. Maybe I can go to the king in confidence and tell him about what's going on with Haman. So he's actually looking to knock Haman down a peg in people's eyes because he's scared that Haman and Esther want to kill him and steal his throne. All because of a dream. Notice how this whole thing changes because God popped a dream in one man's head. We've got the whole of Klal Yisrael's life on the line right here. Everyone is like mummish on the line. And what happens? One man has one dream once and the whole thing changes. God just made a dream happen. He woke up in the middle, he couldn't sleep. He had a dream that Haman and Esther want to kill him. So now he's completely frenzied and he's like making all these bizarre from one dream, one dream. So that's why he said, quickly, take the garment on your horse yourself. And just as you've spoken, a garment that I've worn on a horse that I've ridden. And you've got to clothe the man and lead him and call out. Because you suggested that this be done by common people rather than noble minister. Well, that's not good. Rather, I want you to do so yourself to Mordechai the Jew. Now, Ahasuerus was concerned that Haman might openly reject this, saying that while you agree to dress a man in the royal clothing and lead him on a horse, you will not lower yourself to call out the proclamation in the streets of the city. You know, Haman's never going to pull this through. So let me tell you now, you can't let a word drop. Everything you've said that you've got to do, I want it done. Now, it's interesting. Why didn't Haman say, Al Tigra Dovar, which would have meant don't omit anything. But he said, Al Tapel Dovar, which just means don't let a word fall. He says, don't allow yourself to do anything you suggested to lose its original value. They would have less of an impact on a potential informant if anyone else but you were actually to lead Mordechai on the horse. It's you that I want people to think less of, because it's you that I want people to come and tell me that you're trying to kill me. So you've got to do this. Don't get someone else to do it. Don't dispatch this to one of your underlings and say it was a minister of Haman that did it. Haman's got to lead him. Otherwise, the whole point doesn't mean anything. Don't let one word drop here. Interesting. Now we've got to turn to a Gemara in Megillah, Tesan Amud Aleph 16a, which we've referred to several times. And it says the Gemara, do so to Mordechai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Now first the king said, do so to Mordechai. And Haman said, but there are many Mordechais. It was a very common Persian name, like John. It's a very, very common name. So Haman said, which Mordechai do you mean? So the king said, Mordechai HaYehudi, Mordechai the Jew, John the Jew. Do it for John the Jew. So Haman immediately objected, and he said, there are many Jews called John. Which one do you mean? He says, the one that's sitting at the king's gate. Now, this is very interesting. When the king said, do so for Mordechai, he was worried that Haman might object, saying, there's lots of Mordechais. Mordechai is sold to me along with all the other Jews to be killed. Why should I give him such an honour? So the king said, Mordechai, the Jew who sits at the king's gate. What does that mean? Yes, you're right, he's Jewish. And yes, you're right, you've bought him and you can do what you want with him. But he wasn't sold to you as a slave because he's considered one of my ministers. In fact, he even sits at the king's gate. That's why it says in Medrash Esther 5:9, Haman was sold to Mordechai as a slave because Mordechai gave Haman and his army bread during a war. We did discuss this. And that was that Haman and his troops were starving to death. And Haman sold himself for loaves of bread for himself and his army. Now, the king knew of this episode because Haman's army was staffed completely by Ahasuerus' soldiers. And Mordechai's providing them with food was officially recorded in the king's annals. So that's why I said, do for Mordechai the Jew, even though he's a Jew, and even though you own him, he's not your slave still, he's mine because he sits at the king's gate. So don't you think you can't do this for him and say, well, I can't do this for a Jew because Jews are already, they're mine. I can do what I want with. You can't tell me what to do with them. Remember we had a 10,000 talent of silver sale on this where it's mine now? That's why I don't want you to consider it demeaning to honour him by claiming that he's your slave because you bought him. He's not your slave. He's my slave. Verse 11. This is a tough one for Haman. Bit of a turnaround here. V'yikach Haman esa levush ve'esa sus. So Haman did what he was told. And he took the garment. And he took the horse. V'yilbeish es Mordechai. And he clothed Mordechai. And he led him through the city square. And he called out before him word for word. This will be the honour done to the man who the king desires to honour. Fulfilling Ahasuerus' idea, the people will see this and have less fear of Haman. And if they know of a plot against the king done by Haman, they'll tell him. Now, the Medrash says very famously that when Haman carried out this order, he groaned and sighed. He went, "Ay, it was so unpleasant for him to do this. It was so difficult." But he did not mount Mordechai on the horse until they actually reached the main city square. That he couldn't do. He says, you only get on the horse at the last possible moment. And the Gemara Megillah says that Haman sighed while he dressed Mordechai in the royal garments. And the Gemara derived that information from the verse which says, Voi, Vayilbash. Voi, voi, it says Vav Yud twice. That is, he went oi vai while clothing Mordechai, and another while he led him on the horse. So the Medrash Esther Rabbah 10:5 says the following, which is extremely important to understand. Very deep idea here now. This is really where Haman himself sees the folly of his plan and the fact that God has turned the tables on him. So when Mordechai was riding on that horse, Mordechai himself started to say Kapitel Tehillim, Lamed. He started to say Psalms 30. And what did he say? I shall exalt you, O Lord, for you have drawn me up and not allowed my enemies to rejoice over me. O Lord, my God, I beseeched you and you healed me. Lord, you raised my soul up from the netherworld. You allowed me to live instead of causing me to descend to the pit. And when the people in the street who were Mordechai's disciples were around him, they heard him saying these Tehillim, they carried on and they said, carrying on, sing to the Lord, O his pious ones, and give thanks to the remembrance of his holiness. For his anger is only a fleeting moment, but his favour is life. In the evening, a man may lie down crying, but in the morning he will sing out in joy. So those are verses 5 and 6. While this was going on, says Esther Rabbah 10:5, Haman himself recited verses 7 and 8. What did he say? He said, I said in my tranquility, I shall never falter. O Lord, it is all through your will. You set up a mountain on a firm base. You had hidden your face. I am now in shock. Haman said that. When Esther heard Haman say that, she said, I would call out to you, O Lord. I would offer my supplication to the Lord. What use is my death descending to the pit? Shall dust thank you? Would it espouse your truth? That's verses 9 and 10. Then what did the soul of Klal Yisrael upstairs in Shemayim say? Verses 11 and 12. Hear, O Lord, and favour me. Lord, be a help to me. You've turned about my mourning and become dancing for me. You've opened my sackcloth and girded me with happiness. And Hashem himself quoted verse 13. He finished it off and said, in order that my honour will sing to you and that I will not be silent, Lord my God, I shall thank you forever. The Shekhinah itself praised, as it were, Hashem. Very amazing Gemara. The most amazing bit is Haman HaRosha admitting in verses 7 and 8 of Psalm 30, I'm in shock. I can't believe how this has panned out. I just can't believe it happened. Unbelievable. How did it all happen like that? Incredible. So what did Haman say? No wonder I didn't realize that God would never forsake his people. For I said in my tranquility, says Haman, in Tehillim Lamed, verse 7 and 8, Zion through Ches, I shall never falter. I'm going to kill all the Jews, and I'm going to be the ruler of the world. It's going to be great. His progress in the palace was simply not natural. It wasn't his worth to be so greatly exalted, to have his own seat, his own throne, higher than all the other seven ministers, and they're wiser than him, and he's not. And Achashverosh only listens to him, and he becomes number two in the country. Oh, but you know, in a few weeks, I was junior to seven ministers more distinguished than me. We said that in 1:14. And in one fell swoop, this whole thing with Vashti, I was promoted above them all in 3:1. In Esther 3:1, I'm now the most important minister in all of Medo-Persia. Such a rise to power could not have been luck. Haman now admits it must have been from Hashem, that all is through your will and that you set up my mountain, i.e. my high office, or even the Sotan himself, the guardian angel he who was cashing in on to go in the middle of the night to ask Haman to be hanged on a firm base. But Haman says, no one could have blamed me that I was self-confident because I thought my ascent could only be due to God's great might. That's why I said I'll never falter. But you raised me up for good reason. You only brought me up high to make sure my fall would be drastic. That's why when Rivka went to Shaman Ava to ask about her very difficult pregnancy, they told her, you've got two nations warring for each other. When one is high, the other will be low. When Esav is high, Klal Yisrael will be lowly. When Klal Yisrael is high, Esav will be lowly. When one rises, the other falls. Now I see, says Haman, that Israel's troubles did not lead to their destruction. Rather, it was just made to appear that way, but you hid your face, and therefore I was in shock. Though not only will Israel not be annihilated, as is my plan, but they're even going to win out over me. Absolutely amazing that we see here a complete turnabout in the man himself. This is the first moment where he can't believe what's happening, and even he praises God While Mordechai is saying to him, this is very similar, I would like to point out, to Yosef praising God while he's being led around the streets in Pharaoh's chariot. And he kept his head down and davened. And that's where Yosef had been lifted up against all the difficulty in his life, being pulled out of jail. Now Mordechai is being pulled out of literally sackcloth. He's taken off his sackcloth and put on the royal garments, and now is being paraded about as a hero through the streets. It's got to be a message from Shemayim. And that is not lost on Haman either. It's so extreme. Yes, it's not an open miracle like the plagues in Egypt. Yes, it's not like the splitting of the sea. But it is no less obvious that God's hand is involved. It is obvious even to Haman. Anybody with an unprejudiced mind will see at this point in time, things are now in God's control. And with that, I would like to say something which is from Rabbi Hutner, the Pachat Yitzchak, which he says is an absolute incredible piece of information. If you don't mind that I could just give you this, it's just such a wonderful piece of information. I wonder if I could, I'd see my notes. He says, it's a very interesting thing. He says like this, he says, how is it that Haman could at this moment in time praise God when he realizes that his very plan to aggrandize himself has ended up aggrandizing his arch nemesis, Mordechai? Why does that lead to him praising God? He says an incredible thing. It brings about a famous Rambam on Megillah 2:18 and the Yerushalmi Megillah 1:5 that says after the Mashiach comes, none of the Yomim Tovim will be celebrated except for Purim. Tisha B'Av will be a happy day where that'll be the key of the redemption, because that will be the Mashiach's birthday, as it were. It's where he started to kick off events. But the only Yontif that will be kept properly as we keep it now will be Purim. Everything else will change in its demeanor. Sukkos will still be kept. The Goyim especially will keep Sukkos. But the Yontif, which will essentially be the same as it is now, is Purim. What's going on? So Rav Hutner gives the most amazing parable. It's a worth coming moment. If you were questioning whether or not to come tonight, this at this time is why you should have come. He says this is it's a parable for life. It's amazing. He says like this. This is an analogy. It's an analogy only to get an idea through. He says two people were given the task of identifying strangers at night. And one had a lamp and was able to clearly discern their identity, while the other had no lamp and he had to train himself to identify them using other faculties like sound, smell, touch, whatever it was. Now the lamp afforded the first person a very clear picture during the night, so he had a much better job of identifying that person at night. But when the morning came and the sun dwarfed the dimmer light of the lamp that the person had used during the night serves no purpose. The other person, who had sharpened his other faculties of perception during the night, now had a distinct advantage. In addition to being able to seeing the person because of the sun, all the other senses he had sharpened during the night are still with him, complementing his vision rather than being rendered superfluous by it. When he couldn't see at night, he had to master some kind of alternative means of identification, and he gained that ability. And once he gained it, it was useful even when the sun came. That's the analogy Rabbi Hutner gives. What's the nimshul? All the other festivals are a zeicha liyetzias Mitzrayim. They commemorate the coming out of Egypt, where there was open miracle of divine providence. It was plain for Jew and Gentile to see. And when the super light of the ultimate redemption of the Mashiach will come, that light will dwarf all those earlier miracles. And it says that in Yeshaya 30:26. He says the light of the Mashiach will make what happened in Mitzrayim, Like nothing. So much so there's even a question in the Haggadah, whether we'll still be saying the Haggadah at the time of Mashiach. Will we still say it at night? The answer is yes. We'll still recite the Haggadah, but it's a question because it will be used. The 10 plagues of Egypt will be nothing compared to the 10 plagues at the time of Mashiach. The Purim power of discerning God, even in the most abject darkness, will remain with the Jews for all time. And that will continue to give us an additional dimension of perception that even the brightest light cannot provide. The Gentiles will see God when, like, the sun shines and it's obvious he's doing open miracles, like anyone can. You'll see him, they'll see him. But they hadn't had 3,000 years of exile where they've trained to understand God's movements hidden in the natural world. Even when God reveals himself openly at the time of Mashiach, he'll still be moving about in a natural way through the natural order. Only the Jews will perceive that. That'll be a secret light that is only available for the Jew who has sharpened themselves on Megillas Esther. They can see God's movements. Even Haman, to a certain extent, had to say, yeah, this is true. It's obvious that when the Jews study Megillah, they'll see just how God does business, even in Golas. And that's why it says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, your God, who has taken you out the land of Egypt. But Istar Pano Beyomahu, I will surely conceal my face on that day. It says in Devarim 31:18. There are two revelations. One is overt, and one is the Anochi Panoi Bayom Ha'u. The time of Esther, I concealed myself. This very discerning light of Anochi remains undiminished for all time for all the Jews that have trained themselves to see God. When God reveals himself at the time of Mashiach, there'll be no argument that he's there. He'll reveal himself in a way that it's unarguable. Even the Gentiles will have to grudgingly admit, what can we do? Hashem is actually real and he's true. The Jews will see a light of Hashem that's much deeper. Because the Jews, just like Mordechai, says, see, there's no open miracle, but it's obvious God is there. That training will train the Jews differently. Purim's there for all time. Because the light of Purim is the hidden light of God. And that's only accessible when you've sharpened faculties to be able to see it. It's not obvious and overt. Right here. In this pasuk, when Haman is leading Mordechai through the streets, is the ultimate time where he, Esther, Haman, Klal Yisrael, his disciples, and even God make point of this. We would never have thought that such a difficult situation would see this happening in the middle of it. It is obvious God's got involved, but yet it is so very hidden. At the end of the days, from a Chashrosh's perspective, when he's reading the Megillah, he goes, yeah, because I thought Haman and Esther were trying to kill me. That's why this happened. But this is obviously out of a Chashrosh's control. It makes too much sense based upon the backstory as to why this is so bizarre. But you have to look at it like that. That's the light of Purim. That's the hidden light of Purim. And that's something which stays with us, even Yom Yisrael Mashiach. Even in the time of Mashiach, when Harry of Emmanuel, please God. That's extremely important to understand. When Klal Yisrael are saved, the Shekhinah also comes out of Golas. And that's why the Shekhinah itself praised, as it were, God coming back home by saying in the Tehillim, in order that my honour will sing to you and that I will not be silent, I shall thank you, O Lord, forever. Shekhinah is saying to Hashem, when you come back, this is going to be a big revelation. Look at verse 12. V'yoshev Mordechai al Sha'ar HaMelech. And Mordechai returned to the king's gate. Says the Medrash Rabbah that if you've donned sackcloth, if you've taken a vow to don sackcloth, you don't take it off until God's answered you. There's a machlokes. Did he put the sackcloth back on? Did he not put it back on? Says the Medrash Rabbah, he took off the king's garment and went and put his sackcloth on because still the Jews weren't definitely safe. So that's what he means. He returned to the king's gate and put on his sackcloth. It didn't faze him. You'd have thought, once I put on the king's garments, I'm a different man, I'm a hush of a guy. I get driven around in a limo. Come on, things are different. Straight to work. That was God's doing. Straight back to sitting and fasting and wailing with my disciples until God saves every single Jew. This was just a blip of COVID that didn't in any way shift Mordechai. He went straight back to work. And Haman was driven home, mourning, with his head covered. He was dismayed that he had to disgruntledly go through this demeaning experience at the hand of the very man he wants to kill more than anybody else. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. Notice he was driven home passively. Other people drove him home. And he was mourning. He was mourning with his head covered. He was as upset, says the Medrash, as someone who would experience the death of a loved one. That's how gutted he was. He realized everything that's happening to him must be the hand of God. It ain't going to end. He realizes now is the beginning of his doom. And one or another, God's got it in for him. And he's like he's a dead man walking. That's how he feels about himself. Completely dejected. The Yalkut Shmoni says, when Mordechai, the Yalkut Shmoni in 1056, says that when Mordechai got back to the king's gate, he donned his sackcloth and put ashes back on his head. And he swore, he made it, if this week's parsha is all about Nedarim and Shavuos, if you make an oath or a vow, you must meet it. Mordechai swore that he would not remove his sackcloth until Israel was redeemed. He took off those garments, he went straight back to the camp, put back on his sackcloth, put ashes on his head, sat down and started wailing again. Absolutely incredible. Mordechai was ensuring that the Jews would not place their trust in him by hoping that he would urge Esther to plead with the king on their behalf. Rather, the Jews should still keep crying out to heaven to complete their tshuva. We did say that it was at the end of the tshuva process that God ripped up this old decree made of clay. We did say that. You need the tshuva. And he knows that. And that's why he's pushing. He's saying, look, don't think now I'm all, you know, hoity-toity and I'm going to save you. I'm back here. The situation is live. Keep davening. Even though Haman had fallen from grace and he had to be driven to his home. What was in his home, by the way, Rabbi Say? What was in his home? None other than the gallows, which is going to hang him. He was driven to his home forcefully. Back to those gallows, which he had prepared on the ground of his own home. Even Haman's sons were included in the decree of wiping out Haman. He felt this. That's why he said mourning with his head covered. Because he realized this isn't just going to hit him. It's going to hit his children. Mumish. Unbelievable. Incredible. Let's look at verses 13 and 14 together. Notice what's going on here. He gets home. Remember, he spoke to his beloved friends and his wife. And he said, it just couldn't get better for me. But I've just got a problem. I've got this horrible, wicked Jew, Mordechai, who's really a thorn in my side. I can't enjoy my life unless, there's Mordechai. They said, don't worry. Just build a gallows out of a thorn bush because God can't save people who have been hanged. That's what Zeresh said. Go to Achashrosh in the morning and ask him to do it. And he hastened in the middle of the night to go do it. Now he's coming home to his own family. This is all happening in between the two parties. He comes home to his family and he has a discussion with the same people that told him to go and hang Mordechai. Unbelievable. Haman related to Zeresh's wife and to all of his beloved friends all that had happened to him. That he went in the middle of the night. He wanted to get Mordechai killed at their advice with the whole thing with hanging. And this is what happened. And he's now had to walk around the streets. It's been the worst day of his life. And his wise men and Zeresh and his wife said to him as follows. If Mordechai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but rather you shall surely fall before him. They knew he was of Jewish descent. Why are they saying that? They were still speaking with him when the king's chamberlains arrived and rushed to bring Haman to the feast, which Esther had made. Feast number two. He's being called. Literally, they drive up. A limousine comes up. You know, bodyguards come out and say, excuse me, Mr. Haman, you've got to go to the party. The king wants you at Esther's party. As he was talking about this situation with them. What's What's going on? Very interesting idea. There is a Gemara in Megillah, same page, 16a. It says, Haman was relating all of this to his friends. And shouldn't it say his beloved friend said to him, why his beloved friends now called wise men? Rav Yochanan says, anyone who says anything wise, even a Gentile, is called a wise man. He's a chacham. What was their wisdom? Asks the Al Sheikh HaKadosh. What was their great wisdom? What was their beloved friends? What was his wife saying? Astrology. Astrology. They understood through astrology and they discovered what would happen to Haman through Benjamin's offspring. That's what we said earlier. That was a Medrash Bereishis Rabbah 73:5. The downfall of Edom and Amalek come through the descendants of Rochel. Because it says in Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah 49:20, the youngest of the flock will surely drag them away. That means the descendants of Benjamin, who is the youngest son of Rochel, will defeat Edom and Amalek. So if you look at verse 13, it says Haman's wife before his beloved friends. It says, and Haman related to Zeresh's wife and to all of his beloved friends. But later on in the verse, it says, and the wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him. Haman was talking to all of his friends about all that had happened to him to gain some kind of comfort in this terrible day that he's had. That's why his wife was mentioned first, because she was most beloved and he expected to get most comfort from her. But it was actually the listener's response to him that was based on the knowledge of astrology. So the wise men came before the wife because they had more to say. What were they saying? What is the advice? What's going on? And with this, hopefully, we can finish the perek. He related everything that had happened, and essentially he was dumbfounded. Think about how weird this was for Haman. One minute, he's got a plan to kill Mordechai and make himself the happiest man on earth and go to Esther's party. And the next minute, he's walking home in doom and gloom, having elevated Mordechai to a state he couldn't have dreamed himself personally. And now he realizes that the entire world that he's built up for himself is about to fall on him and his family. When he said all that had happened to him, why do we need that word? Why do we need that word? Just say he related what had happened to him. What that means is the one whom Haman had acquired, along with the rest of Israel, that's Mordechai, had been involved in this incident that he was relating. And Haman's wise men said, oh, the one that you've bought, Mordechai, who you hate, has done this to you? So they said as follows. Within the ranks of the Jews, there are many clans. And they all have different divisions and different genealogy. Now, if Mordechai is of a Jewish descent, now of the particular seed from whom you've begun to fall, specifically from King Shaul, who wiped out Amalek, albeit not very well, if he comes from King Shaul, had power against Amalek, then we are not going to win this. And even though you might have bought the Jews with good money to destroy them, it's not going to work. That's only if he is a Jew of Benjamin. That's why it says, Neifel Tafel. You will surely fall. You'll fall in front of him. That means you'll fall in front of his ancestor, Shaul. But through astrology, they could have described to Haman the process of the downfall through Esther. You see, they could have said that Haman could have immediately gone to the king and apologized, telling Achashverosh that he had not known Esther was Jewish and that he had never intended to buy the queen. And the king would have certainly believed him because Esther hadn't revealed her people's origins to the king. So when Esther presented her case to Achashverosh, the king would not be furious with Haman because he's pre-apologized. That would be fantastic. That's his only way out. People, this is the only way out. His friends were telling him, you got a way out. Run now to the king. Explain that Esther must also be from Benjamin. That's why this is happening to you. Apologize profusely. And then when Esther reveals the fact that she's Jewish, you're fine. Indeed, that would have saved his skin. As his friends were saying those words to him, where he was planning to go to the king and get himself out of shtuch, up come the chamberlains in the limousine and drag him to the party. You see what God just did? Just another case of saving Klal Yisrael. The very piece of information he knew which would save the Nazi party. Go to the king, explain the situation. He then will drop the conspiracy act against you. When Esther hatches the plan to say, oh, I've been sold, goes, no, you haven't, because we've already organised that you've not been sold. I've spoken it out with Haman already. And that's the end of Megillas Esther. What did God do? Right at that moment, he didn't have a chance. Off to the party. Go meet your fate. Unbelievable. God didn't miss a beat. There's another interpretation to say, when Haman came home and told him of all that had happened, he was saying, this is you, my wife and my friends, this is your fault. Weren't you the ones to tell me just a few hours ago that I should go to Ahasuerus and I should get Mordechai hanged? Didn't you? And I was fulfilling your advice. And look how that panned out. That panned out with the fact that now the whole thing's gone to pot and now me and my family might be killed. This is your fault. That's what it means. Haman related to Zeresh's wife and to all of his beloved friends, all that had happened to him. He was complaining about this episode and he was complaining about their involvement with it. If it wasn't for you guys, none of this would have happened. I was only doing what you told me earlier on, which is true. That's why they said, if Mordechai be who you, before you've begun to fall as a Jew descent, specifically from Shaul, specifically from Benjamin, then you've got nothing to do. There's, in which case, it's nothing you can do. It's not our fault. If he's from Mordechai, astrologically, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing we can do. It's completely Ein Brera. It's beyond our control. So don't come and blame us. Look at the star sheets. If he is from Shevet Benjamin, you're done for and we're all done for. And it's got nothing we can do can say that can change this. So don't blame me. They're defending themselves using astrology. But to comfort Haman, they introduced a new idea. What happens if he isn't from Shaul? What happens if he's not a Benjaminite? Ah, then it's not so bad. Maybe if he's not from Shaul and he's not from Benjamin, you will be able to overcome him. This gave him a bit of nechemta, gave him a bit of like solace. And just as he thought, yeah, Tucker, you know what? I'll just go to the queen. I'll just go to the king. I'll explain the whole situation. I get just as he was doing it, Chamberlain's turned up. Off to go. He doesn't have a moment to speak to the king in private. He now has to go and be in Esther's presence. That's why the king's chamberlains rushed to call for Haman. They rushed to bring him to the feast as if it was his free will has been abrogated. What does it say in the actual pasuk? They were still speaking with him, Zeresh and their beloved friends. And they were saying, oh, you know, don't worry, maybe he's not Jewish, or maybe he's not from that clan. Maybe. And as soon as they were hatching this plan, they rushed to bring Haman to the feast against his will. He said, no, give me an extra 10 minutes to figure this out. You've got to go now. The king is insistent. Again, God steps in to prevent the only way Haman could have got off the hook. Just another point to show that Haman knew it was doomsday. After all that had happened with Mordechai, maybe he's got one political diplomatic way out of this. As soon as he learns what to do with the very same friends that got him into this hassle, the very same friends that are telling him to go and do this, maybe they can actually get him out. That very moment, he's forced against his will to get into a situation where he can't do that diplomatically. He can't do it. The actual tables have turned, the actual luck that he had experienced prior in having the king's ear has run dry. And now suddenly, he is just being shifted about like a commodity. Very unusual for him. This is all happening in the period of 72 hours, the entire changeover. And this has only happened in the last 24 hours. Suddenly the tables have turned. And with that, we complete the sixth perek. And in the seventh perek, which is really the denouement for Esther, we've been building up to the, especially 7-4, which is where Esther spills the beans. And she's like, yeah, I've got to tell you something. I've been sold down the river by this guy. Which is the plan that we have been cooking up through the third and fourth brochim. This is now where it all comes to a head. So the sixth perek was vital, even though it seems as if we could have jumped from 5 to 7. We see that the sixth perek was the turnabout click. It was the absolute latch which shut on Haman. Now that's going to come to fruition in the words that Esther's going to say. And please God, we'll do that next time. We'll go through at least, hopefully get at least to verse four to see actually Esther say these words, say this is it. And if I can, I've eyed up till verse 9, if we can, in a block, just to get through that much. And actually see Haman's downfall now suddenly happen in what essentially is a cascade of just a few hours. From the time he arrives at the party to Ahasuerus saying, look, now we're at the party. What is it you wanted to tell us at the last party that you didn't? Was minutes. Minutes. And then once Esther says what she says and he's completely shocked, the next thing that happened is he falls on Esther because the archangel Michal pushes him on Esther. And indeed, there is a plot between Haman and Esther as Ahasuerus sees it. And he says, right, that's it. That's it. End of story. Then all we've got to do, now we've got rid of Haman, is change the decree that's already been sent out in the memos from the second and third Purim. We had an internal and an external memo that still said all the Jews have basically got to be murdered. That we've got a problem with. We need to find out how we can undo that because they've already been sealed. But this basically is really the beginning of the end of Haman right here. So, you know, chapter 7 is really where he absolutely, it's curtains for him, as we're about to see. And please God, we'll see that. Then we need to wrap up the Megillah story as to how things change. And please God, we can complete already Megillah. Already once you get to the 7th chapter, the end is in sight. Because this is really the wrap up. So please God, we'll get through as much of the 7th parak as we can next time. I wish you a wonderful week and Shabbos. And if there's any questions...